Now our message for you today is taken from the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 27. Let me read a few verses. Chapter 27, verse 1. And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. Now down at verse 9. Now when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them, said unto them, Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and ship, but also of our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and the owner of the ship more than those things which was spoken by Paul. And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, the more part advised to depart thence also, if by any means they might attain to Phinis, and there to winter, which is an haven of Crete, and lieth towards the southwest and northwest. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing thence, they sail close by Crete. Now let us pause there for a moment or two in our reading and try and find a lesson from these opening verses that will set the background for our study. Now in this chapter we approach the completion of the plan and purposes of God as outlined in the Acts of the Apostles, with the pathway from Jerusalem to Rome being completed. The closing verse of chapter 26 says, This man might have been set at liberty, but Agrippa did not understand that it was not God's will for Paul to be set free at this time. The opening verse of chapter 27 declares, It was determined that we should sail into Italy. Now, you pause and you ask yourself this question, Who was it that determined that we should sail into Italy? See, it simply says, and when it was determined, was it the master of the ship who determined this? Or was it those who were in charge of Paul? That's what men may think. But now we must keep in mind that God had determined that his servant Paul should testify in Rome. So men simply carried out the purposes of God. I wish that everyone could grasp this situation. Sometimes men think that they are directing the course of world affairs. Some men think that if they get into the place of office, the place of power, that they will be able to do this or do that or do something else. And sometimes we look at the news and we listen to what is being reported and we think that certain men are making certain decisions. But it's good to understand this, that God overrules in the affairs of men. That's easily proved from a study of the Bible and a study of history. But now then, it was not God's will then for Paul to be set at liberty at this time. In the Acts of the Apostles, the history starts in Jerusalem. You remember I said that at the very beginning. The preaching of the gospel and the establishing of the church was in Jerusalem, which was the very heart of Jewish religion. But it concludes in Rome, the very heart of political and the power of the great Roman Empire at that time. Both their political and the military power was rested right there in Rome. And the gospel is preached first in the very place of the Jews' religion. And in the Acts of the Apostles, it's carried from one place to another until we find the great apostle testifying in Rome. So when it says it was determined, we should realize this, that God had determined it. Now, in the opening verses of the chapter, it is possible to follow the course of the voyage until they arrived at the port named the Fair Havens. Also, it is interesting to note Paul's companions. They had certain companions on that boat. Aristarchus was with them. He was a Macedonian from Thessalonica. And so therefore, it's interesting to watch that he was with them. In fact, you'll find that others are there. And it may be that when you think of those who were travelling with Paul, no doubt they were able to comfort one another in the midst of their difficulties. And now the ship is sailing over the waters, and they come to this place called the Fair Havens. But now, the idea is this: they might have stayed there, but Paul gives them some advice, and they refuse to take Paul's advice. As you read down through this, there are one or two things that strike you in your reading. We come now to see a drifting ship. Remember, a ship was never meant to drift, but something had gone wrong. They moved out on the advice of the majority. That's what it says when you come to verse 12. And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, wasn't big enough for them, there wasn't sufficient things there to interest them to wait all winter. The more, that is, the majority advised to depart thence also, if by any means they might attain to Phinis, and there to winter. So therefore they wanted to get to something that would be more interesting, a place that would be more popular and more to do. And so they took the advice of the majority, number one. And so therefore in verse 13 it says, and when the south wind blew softly. And so you have the majority who gave their advice. And then there was the soft wind blowing, and because the soft wind was blowing, they were deceived by this. They made the great error of supposition, because it says, and supposing that they had obtained their purpose. Notice three things then that led on to drifting ship. First, they moved out on the advice of the majority and against the advice of the man of God. They were deceived by the blowing of a soft wind. They made the great error of supposition, and all these things landed them in difficulties. I wonder how many people have been governed by the majority vote, and they think because the crowd is doing it, it must be right. If the majority thinks this, then that's the thing we've got to do. Now, we're living in a day when we're guided more or less by majority vote. Now, while it may appear right at some times, I want to remind you of this, as I have done over and over again while preaching the word. In the days of Noah, the majority were wrong. All the world believed that Noah was wrong, and only his wife and his three sons and their wives believed him and went into the ark. Eight souls in all were preserved. The rest of the world perished in the judgment. The majority was wrong, the minority was right. When the Lord Jesus Christ was here on earth, he said, straight is the gate and narrow is the way that leadeth to life, and few, the minority that find it. But wide is the gate and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be, that is, the majority go in thereat. Would you rather go with the majority on the broad road that leads to a lost eternity, or go with the minority in through the narrow gate to the way of life that leads to heaven above? See, my friend, you've got to be prepared to view this. Majority or minority? Here they went with the advice of the majority, and they were wrong. And then circumstances seemed to be in their favour. The soft wind was blowing. So that must be right. It's time to sail out. Well, this would suggest to us that sometimes people think that because everything's going in their favour, well, that's fine. I must be doing the right thing, because I'm gaining with this. My friend, don't be deceived by circumstances. Circumstances can change very quickly. then we supposed the error of supposition. I wonder how many people make this mistake, supposing. Now, you know, when you read through the Bible, you find that people suppose these things. Away in chapter 16, I pointed out to you that a man was about to take his own life, ready to become a suicide, supposing that the prisoners had fled, and the prisoners hadn't fled. They were still there. And yet, he supposed that they had fled. You see, you and I can make great mistakes on the strength of supposition. We mustn't be led by supposition. We must learn the truth. But now, you'll notice something else. The ship is drifting on. And as you read down through this passage, and when the ship was caught and could not bear up into the wind, we let her drive. She's drifting. And running under a certain island which is called Clauda, we had much work to come by the boat, which when they had taken up, they used helps undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should fall into the quicksands, straight sail, and so were driven. They were at the mercy of the waves. And we being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day they lightened the ship, and the third day we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. I once asked an old seafaring man what was meant by that, that they threw out the tackling of the ship. He looked at me and he said, for the many years that I went out on the sea, he was an old fisherman, without one of the fishing boats, week after week. He said, of all the years I've been on the sea, I've never known an occasion when we had to do that. But he said, it simply means, if they threw out all the tackling of the ship, that they were at the stage where they were almost lost. That is, they feared, and it was all hope was gone, at the mercy of the waves, hope abandoned. Well, now that's the condition they were in. And then, verse 20 says, and when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away, hope abandoned. It was a dark night. They saw no sun by day, no stars by night. Now remember, in these days, when they were sailing through the Mediterranean in the sailing ships, they were guided by the sun, and by the moon and the stars. They didn't have all the modern things that we have today. They didn't have the ideas that they have aboard airplanes or aboard ships today. They didn't have the compasses, and they didn't have all the ideas now where they can almost see in the dark. They didn't have these electronic gadgets that men have today. They had to depend on the sun, the moon and the stars. And here for 14 days, for 2 weeks, they saw neither sun nor stars. What were they to do? Drifting along at the mercy of the storm. This meant that they had no means of guidance. They simply drifted in the dark. I wonder how many of my listeners today are drifting in the dark. Or perhaps you know people who are just drifters, drifting along in darkness, that is, in nature's darkness. Or they don't know the light of God's word. They've never come to the light. Jesus said, I am the light. I am the light of the world. But they've never trusted him. There are a lot of people, you know, have a lot of knowledge of certain things, but they don't have the knowledge of salvation. They're in the dark, and they're just drifting on through life with no hope. And that's what they were doing. It was a dark, dark night, and they had no means of guidance. But then there were dangerous rocks here, and that's what they were afraid of. Because as you read further down, and you, verse 29, then fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast four anchors out of the stern and wished for day. Dangerous rocks. Have you ever thought, my friend, if a ship is sailing along through the ocean, if that ship's captain or whoever is on the lookout can see a rock which is standing up out of the water, then it's easy for them to avoid that rock. But you cannot see the hidden rocks. Hidden rocks are dangerous rocks. Hidden rocks are those that are under the surface, and you may run onto these rocks, or you may be swept onto the rocks with the storm or the wind. Many a ship has been wrecked on hidden rocks. May I remind you that many a life has been wrecked on unsuspected rocks. May I suggest some of the rocks that have destroyed men's lives? What about that dangerous rock of covetousness? We're warned about this away back even in the commandments of the Old Testament. Thou shalt not covet. It's a dangerous rock. When men start to covet, they find themselves in danger. Could you think at the moment of some of the things that men covet? Have you thought of men who covet money? They see one of their neighbors who has plenty of money, and they covet him, and they determine they're going to have money at all costs, no matter how they're going to get it, and they wreck their own lives on the rock of covetousness. Of course, it may not be money, it may be certain things. We're not to covet what belongs to our neighbor, neither his possessions nor his partner. Some men have coveted their neighbor's wives. They've coveted their neighbor's house. They've coveted their neighbor's property. And it's led them into sin and to destruction. What about the hidden rock of pride? Oh yes, many a man has been wrecked on the rock of pride, and many a woman. Pride, you know, is a very dangerous rock. Some people get very proud, and none of us at our best have anything to be proud about, because we're all descendants of Adam, members of Adam's lost and ruined race. God resisteth the proud, but he giveth grace to the humble. There's the dangerous rocks of pride. May God forbid that any of us should ever run onto the rock of pride. Oh, but there's another dangerous rock I might suggest to you. It's the dangerous rock of self-will. You know, that's a common one. It's common even amongst young people. It starts off when they're little children, when they're doing something and the parents object and tell them to stop, and the little one stamps the foot and says, "I will." That's where it starts. And they grow up, they become teenagers, and in spite of the fact that the parents may try to instruct them and tell them what they should do, what they shouldn't do, and they say, "Oh no, this is what I'm going to do. I will. I will." It's the rock of self-will. But let me carry it a little further. It's all right being self-willed, you know. You think you're doing your own thing, and you think you can get off with it. You treat your parents as if they were old fogies. You may not even listen to the school teacher. You may not listen to the preacher as they try to warn you. You say, "Oh, this is what I'll do. I will." Friend, let me remind you. The dangerous rock of self-will is that which will wreck you and destroy you when, instead of doing the will of God, you put your own will in the place of God's will. It's a very destructive rock. Yes, they feared, fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks. I wonder how many listening to my voice today, you look back over your life and you're saying, "Oh, if somebody had only taken me by the hand, if somebody had just put their arm around my neck and kindly instructed me and told me what to watch in life, but nobody helped me. And I went on and I wrecked my whole life on those hidden rocks." And you're looking back, my friend, and the scars are still there. You're still thinking of the scars you brought on your character because you ran onto those sinful rocks, those dangerous rocks of covetousness or pride or self-will. Perhaps it was the hidden rock of immorality. What was it with you, my friend? did you go on to those rocks? Well, these people feared lest they should have fallen upon rocks. They were desperate men. Verses 17 through 20 set forth the plight of men in desperation. As I have said already, according to the language of sailors, it meant hope abandoned. They cast everything out of the boat. They had nothing left at the mercy of the waves. Ah, but I want you to think for a moment or two. There was a man on that ship by the name of Paul. Of course, he was a prisoner, that's true. But that didn't stop him from being a preacher. You know, Paul, first of all, when he spoke to them, he condemned them for doing the thing that was wrong. Paul spoke out, you know, and he told them they were wrong. But they didn't listen to Paul. Paul told them that they should never have left the place. After long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me, and not have loosed from Crete, and to have gained this harm and loss." See, in his declaration, Paul first of all condemned them for doing the wrong thing. Now, we don't like being told that. I know that people don't like being told or reminded that they have done the wrong thing. But this brings us to the point of conviction, my friend. You see, Paul had to point out to them, first of all, that they had brought this thing upon themselves. If they had listened to him in the first place, it wouldn't have happened. So, first of all, he condemned them for doing the wrong thing. They had refused to listen to good advice and would not heed the warning. They had acted in self-determination, thinking they were right. Paul exhorts them to do the right thing and believe God. Now notice, while they have done the wrong thing in the past, it's not too late to make some change. And he's saying, "For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me." You see, the whole thing is this, is it, sirs, I believe God. He was a man who could stand up and face the people who were journeying with him on that ship. He could point out to them their error in the past, how they had brought all this distress upon themselves, but now in effect he's saying, now look, it's not too late. I still believe God, and I believe it shall be just as God has told me. And this would get hold of the hearts, surely, of these people. Here's a man who knows the living God. He's prepared to trust the living God, and he's telling us that we also should have faith in God. Sirs, I believe God. Now, he didn't say, I believe about God. Oh, no. He didn't simply say, I believe there is a God. I believe God. I want to ask every listener today, do you, my friend, believe God? Not simply believe that there is a God, or believe about God. Do you believe God? The Lord said, He that heareth my word, and believeth him that sent me, hath everlasting life, shall not come into condemnation, but is passed from death unto life.